but I did have a question that I actually left with, and I just had to like sort it out.
Sure.
That this was that Raja Sutra?
Yeah.
That as you expressed, really intimate and beautiful, yeah, to get a glimpse into the mind like that. Yes,
I don't know another sutra that says intimate as that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, so the Buddha was awakened and he still, these thoughts are being born somewhere. And being born, and this may be one of those unponderables, like where did they come from sort of thing. Then you could, you know, guess at it and play at it and tease the mind and all that sort of thing. But if I was to understand this morning's teaching so far, it would be like born out of our tendency towards pleasure or ease. Then these thoughts arise. And so even in the awakened state, these thoughts might arise. Now, Buddha nurturing, or I should say cultivating, I guess, wisdom, was able to see clearly all the falseness around this possible little dream that's coming up, all the, you know, this, all the false pleasure, the false, or the emptiness of it, was able to see that. But where's the cessation in all this? Cessation, and maybe I don't understand that word. When does it stop? When does that, I mean...
Then Mara, the evil one, vanished right there.
Yeah, is it like,
that's,
are we
going
to have to count on cessation in every moment, and then it arises yet again and again and again?
It seems to, huh?
Even before the enlightenment.
Well, you know, there's lots... As I quoted Dogen this morning, the delusion is about being deluded about enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Being enlightened is about being enlightened about delusion. Mm-hmm. When you have an idea of what an awakened one is like, you use that idea as a navigational tool. I don't want to go in that direction. That's like your view. Your understanding. And out of understanding arises intention. Understanding is a condition for generating intention. So when you have an understanding, if your understanding of enlightenment, I mean, I spent years, the first book I ever picked up that talked about enlightenment was 1965. I spent a few years, 20, thinking that enlightenment was some... It was sort of a drugged state, except good. It was blissful, awake, no more troubles. You know, what was the metaphor I was using? Well, sort of like being drunk, you know, it's sort of everything feels good, everything's cool. But it's not a state. The enlightened state, you want to talk about the enlightened states, those are the Brahma Viharas. In my not so admittedly humble opinion. And there isn't, because things don't stop. If you are enlightened, the next thing that's going to happen is delusion. The next thing that's going to happen is change. What, you know, so the understanding of enlightenment is important. Now, I can point you to, but I can't point you to in Tan Jeff's translations online because he doesn't translate these suttas. Sariputta was asked about Nibbana. I don't have the sheet with me in front of me, but I can point it. It's in this section of the Samyutta Nikaya. And Sariputta, the Buddha's senior disciple, the master of the teachings, said, Nibbana is being without greed, hatred, and delusion. That's it. That's Nibbana. Now, there are teachers, including monastics, who will tell you Nibbana is... Ask Bhikkhu Bodhi what the difference was between Nibbana and Upekkha. Upekkha is equanimity. And he said, well, Upekkha is just a mind state. It's just a psychological state. And Nibbana, well, that's the transcendent, unborn, unarising root of all being. And I thought, she sounds pretty much Hindu to me. Advaita. And that's in the teachings. It's scattered around in there. Now, what is Nibbana? What is the unconditioned? Tanjeff doesn't translate that and put it online. But there's a section in the Samyutta Nikaya, the unconditioned. Gather around, monks, I'll tell you about the unconditioned. It's experience unconditioned by greed, hatred, and delusion. No. It's not a magical state. You know, it's not... Well, it certainly is without the unpleasantness of dukkha. But it's not without unpleasantness. Be with the present moment. Yeah, the present moment, you may be sitting on a hot stove. Unpleasant. The Buddha spent his last night with severe stomach pains. Unpleasant. He was fully awakened. Unpleasant. Still. It's not like you get rid of this. There's a great sutta that I don't have with me. Well, it's in there, but I can't. There's a gazillion books in there. The whole world is in there. Where the Buddha, it's very late in his life, just before he dies, and Sariputta and Moggallana, his two senior disciples, who he's been with for 30, 40 years, are gone. And he's standing, looking out over the thousands of monks. I don't know whether there's thousands of monks, but all the monks who were assembled, and he turns to Ananda and says, this is pretty empty here without my friends. Sounds like grieving to me. Sounds like sorrow. A little wistfulness anyway. You know? At least wistful. Give me wistful, if not, you know. It still happens to the Buddha. But he doesn't make it worse by allowing tanha to show up. That craving. I think that the notion of an awakened state is delusional and misleading, and it's an idea that doesn't serve us well. Awakening is something we do every moment, or something we can do every moment. It's an opportunity every moment. To awaken to what? To dukkha. To recognize the unpleasantness. That's all. It's not rocket science. It's not easy. But it's relatively simple. It's just that we don't... It's too simple almost to believe. I like... And when we talk about imponderables... A lot of that has to do with the fact that he didn't have a metaphysical correlate to point to. And it's because he didn't have the metaphor of evolutionary biology. And I regard evolutionary biology as a metaphor. We may think of it as a theory. We may think of it even as true. And if you don't buy it, well then, back to school with you. Although it didn't help the first time. But I find that having that as a metaphysical, as an objective kind of thing, helps me point to that experience in myself, that arising wishing for it to be different. It's not imponderable if you are willing to factor in that that's what this organism has been cultured to do. Now, if we had an ancestor who thought, oh, this is just so wonderful, this being, how I'm going to sit out on this rock and enjoy the sun. That ancestor would be lunch before he had a chance to pass on his genes, so we wouldn't get that guy's tendencies. But like birds, watch birds. These guys are not laid back. You know, at least not the little ones, the sparrows. They are fighting over food, for crying out loud. We've inherited a bunch of that. We come by it honestly. It's just the way we are. So is it imponderable? Not necessarily. But it may be imponderable experientially if you're being completely phenomenological and if you don't have an objective correlate. And I just think of it as a correlate, something to help triangulate for me that experience so I can... And this, we're getting into the next two fetters here, which, are ill will and the desire for sensual pleasantness. We can say, where does that come from? And it's described almost in mystical terms, tanha. What is tanha? It's a special kind of craving. It's not the wanting to turn left at the next intersection. It's the wanting things to be pleasant. It's not when we find that tanha can't be satisfied, it's different than if we find out that we can't turn left at the next intersection. There are actually different words, that in, about the Eskimos and the snow, right? The Eskimos and all their words for snow. There are at least 25 different words in Pali that are glossed as desire. So when we say desire causes suffering, what kind of desire? It's a different kind of desire for awakening than it is for that Porsche Cayenne. Although, becoming an owner of a Porsche Cayenne hybrid is a kind of awakening. Oh my God, the insurance rates. So, if you're looking at the first hindrance is kamachanda. The second truth is about kamatanha. Rupa Raga, which is a passion for... it's Kama Raga. It's a passion. Raga is passion. It's another word that we would gloss as desire, one of those words. Kama Raga, the passion for pleasure. The hindrance is Kama Chanda. Chanda is ethically neutral. It describes a kind of desire. It's a neutral kind of desire. Kamachanda, the desire for pleasant, not so skillful. Dhammachanda, the desire for the Dhamma, skillful. So it's ethically neutral. It can be positive or negative in terms of our relationship to dukkha, depending on its object. Tanha, always negative. And I think of tanha as the built-in quality. I also think of it more as like climate, and kamachanda is like weather. Okay? Does that make sense? So tanha is the tendency to want pleasant experience, but a particular pleasant experience, that dope bar? Kamachanda. The desire for pleasant experience. And it arose for the Buddha. And disappointment arose. But if it's not met with tanha, how does it not meet with tanha? Well, we recognize the manifestation of tanha in kamachanda, or rupa-raga, or sensual. And this suggests that it's physical pleasure. But actually, what I think gives us the most trouble is not physical pleasure. I like to say that dukkha is not about the thermostat. It's not that it's a little too cold or a little too warm. Those things are, we can deal with those. There's six sense bases. There are the five physical senses, and we like our sound harmonious. You know, we hear a tritone, we want it resolved. If it's too loud, we want it turned down. Those endless loops that go with the video games, how do they compose those? The stuff that gets us in trouble is at the mind sense gate. And the Buddha said there were six sense gates, right? Or maybe you don't know, but he identified six sense gates. Each of the five senses in the mind is a sense gate. My reading of the mind as a sense gate is that we're talking about sanya, about perception. It's the understanding, it's the knowing, it's the thinking, it's when the brain represents experience to itself. That's the sense gate. With a memory, a plan, a fantasy, a calculation, a simple recognition. And that simple recognition, that sense gate, can be pleasant or unpleasant. If I say Rush Limbaugh, probably pleasant or unpleasant. Sarah Palin, pleasant or unpleasant. Bruce Springsteen, different reaction. Ice cream. Just thought of it. That staff person that's driving you nuts. Not here in the room, but in the thought. That thought, mind sense gate, and the reaction is what? So pleasant and unpleasant have to do with the mind sense gate. It's the one that gets us in trouble. It's the one that you know, and then we believe the stories. It's the story. And the story is unemployment is going up, or unemployment is going up. Oh no, going down? Oh good. There is a physical correlate to this stuff. If you pay attention, how do you know that ice cream is pleasant and burning yourself on the stove is unpleasant? How do you know? How do you know when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out? You don't figure it out. You don't say, well, breathing in occurs every so. The odds are. I mean, you don't do that. It's a direct knowing. You just directly know pleasant and unpleasant. And that experience of a story or an account, any understanding we have, our attachment to that is a hindrance. Our attachment to the pleasant. It's not that the pleasant is that there's anything wrong with the pleasant. Eat that creme brulee when it shows up. Really? No, pass it up. It doesn't show up that often. It's really good. And I can go off on creme brulee for quite some time. It's not that the pleasant experience, it's the craving for it. It's the wanting it. But as a phrase that contemplating gratification. That's what's going on in the mind when you're thinking about that Porsche or that dessert or that party or the vacation or whatever it is. Or when you finally tell that staff person off. whatever it is contemplating gratification. When you find that going on, explore. What a great opportunity. When you know, when that stuff comes up, and the only thing that enables you to do that is the kind of practicing we do on the cushion, where we learn how to stabilize our attention. Because otherwise, we just lost with the, how could so-and-so be doing that? Doesn't he know? How can I told him 100 times? And it's all in our heads. We're acting out the drama in our mind. And we're back with the moth and the flame again. Contemplating gratification. You're contemplating, you're looking at the flame in your mind. And we're navigating on the basis of that flame. So if the flame is an awakened state, is blissful always. Wow. Nothing is always. Someone just had me at lunch about it. Maybe you were talking about it, and I thought, oh, we think we're talking about the measurements of the universe and astrophysical stuff, and it all makes sense if you regard life as a constant, the speed of life as a constant. But hey, what is a constant? Anything? Isn't the speed of light as constant? Isn't that an article of faith that we believe and cling to? I mean, maybe all of the measurements of dark matter, dark energy, which depend on the notion of the speed of light being a constant, maybe. I don't know. I understand how we got that theory. It's a subjective experience. So maybe it isn't 13 billion after all. Maybe 7,000 is just metaphorical. Contemplating gratification is anticipating. So what are the conditions for desire? It includes the imagining of something more pleasant. Bhikkhu Bodhi says we spend our time trying to maximize pleasant experience, minimize unpleasant experience, and figure out how all this relates to me. When I first heard that, I thought, oh, horrible, shouldn't be doing that. But really, it's what we do. Nothing wrong with it. That's what the organs, that's why I find the evolutionary biology metaphor so helpful. It depersonalizes, it's just what's happening. My job is to learn, to observe it, to watch it, to see it clearly so I don't get tricked. Contemplating gratification, pleasantness. These are feathers, because when you're focused on what you can get, they're all self-based too. They're all based on self. What I can get from this person, we don't see the person. What is another person but a sight for dukkha? All of us here are engaged in dukkha-ing. Or am I wrong? We're doing it all the time. I'm talking too fast. I'm talking too slow. I'm talking about the wrong thing. I don't know. This chair is uncomfortable. My back is hurting. My feet that, once I walk out the door, then I'm back in, Obama land. I mean, there's nothing, But if what we think is, oh, this person, I could got an opportunity here, whatever that might be, then you're not even seeing the person. You're not seeing things. It obscures your ability to see, because you're looking. It's when a pickpocket meets a saint, he only sees the saint's pockets. You ever been there? No, we just don't even know that there's a saint there. So we're imagining. Contemplating And out of that, there's underneath that, there is a dissatisfaction. Not enough right here. Not enough in the moment. This isn't a moral thing. If our organisms had been culturing to be content, we wouldn't be sitting in a room like this. We always want more. The worldly dharmas are great tools for us. Just run through them quickly, because pleasure and pain. We want pleasure, we don't want pain. And our move to avoid them is understandable. It was for survival purposes. And we are survival mechanisms. It's not imponderable, but we don't need to ponder too much once we understand it's not personal. Gain and loss. We want more. Once things are comfortable, we want more. And the Buddha said, 2 mountains of gold wouldn't be enough. And we all know that. We all see everybody, you know. Everybody says, you ask them, income is 15% more, they'd be happy forever. Maybe 20%. But that's what everybody thinks. Doesn't matter whether you're making $500,000 a year or $30,000. Just a little bit, I'll get ahead, I'll be okay. Always more. We want praise, not blame, not criticism. We don't like criticism, do we? Not particularly. Unpleasant. So these fetters are, the fourth and fifth fetter are the desire for sensual desire and ill will. Well, ill will is about not wanting, make it go away, irritation, aversion. And all those words are trying to describe, point at that impulse that arises in us to make them go away. To stop. But Bhikkhu Bodhi said, make things pleasant, improve the pleasant, increase the pleasant, decrease the unpleasant, and see how everything relates to me. Greed, hatred, and delusion. We're actively involved in greed, hatred, and delusion. And praise, and recognition. We want recognition. We don't want to be ignored. I hear somebody cuts you off in traffic. It's being disrespected. Or that great scene in Midnight Cowboy where Dustin Hoffman is walking across the street and the car just creeps, you know, a little bit into the crosswalk and he slams it. I'm walking here. Recognition, not disregard. Pleasant. Versus unpleasant. Learning to recognize the pleasant is really important. And we don't recognize it. We just react to it. We can watch the reaction within ourselves, in our mind, a perception, an idea, a thought. The negative reaction arises. I shouldn't be thinking this. You know, oh, I've been practicing, so I shouldn't be judging myself for not thinking. Oh. You know, I mean, it's reaction is papancha. You know, reaction, feeling tone. If it's pleasant, we want more. If it's unpleasant, we want less. The papancha, the stuff that when you close your eyes to meditate, what comes up? What comes up? Buddha said 3 kinds of papancha. Craving for, you know, pleasant experience. Thinking over views and our understanding, sorting things out. Mm-hmm. And conceit, thinking about ourselves, which involves views and involves pleasant and unpleasant. These pleasant, unpleasant, this pleasant unpleasantness, when it engages, when it encounters tanha. Tanha's climate. It's the ambient state of the being, is to want the pleasant, try to get rid of the unpleasant. In a particular situation, kamachanda, I want that dump bar, that promotion. Praise, how we can spend how long trying to engineer a 15-second bit of praise. You can spend hours, days, lifetimes. We want things to be a certain way. And we think things will be better if they're a certain way, and we judge them negatively when they're not. Things should be this way. It's the heart of judgment again. So judgment is buried in these fetters. Judgment is about our assessment that things would be better, and our delusion that we're right. We want happy endings. We want our stories to have happy endings, right? You know, stories don't have happy ending. Anybody see? Oh, I can't give away the ending. If a movie has an unhappy ending, it probably is going to have trouble getting funding. A triumphant ending for the good guys? All right. The more shoot 'em up, the better. We'll spend lots of money. But a sad ending? There are some current examples which I could point to. I can't even name the movies, but some of them are really good. But we like our stories with happy endings. We like our opinions to meet with agreement, because the opinion comes with us. Just like the world comes with us, just like the deep GPS device, the map comes with the blue dot. Otherwise, it's useless. That's great. That's San Francisco. How do I get anywhere? Where am I? Got to know where you are. And these things, ill will grows from unpleasant experience. All these things, and the anticipation of unpleasant experience, and the kinds of tanha. There are three kinds of tanha. There's kamatanha, which is the thirst. And actually, when we talk about it phenomenologically, it's experienced as thirst for pleasant experience. The thirst, bhavatanha, to be in the future, to become something. You have to survive to become something. So survival and being something in the future. And hopefully that's pleasant. That's what we want. But we prefer any survival to our thought of non-survival. And then vibhavatanha, which is the desire to make go away. How do you deal with someone whose opinion that just drives you nuts? Well, strap on a suicide vest and blow them up. I mean, people, these are not trivial things. These drive people to kill each other and mutilate themselves internally. Right? I mean, this is not trivial. At the mind sense gate, we've got all our memories, our plans, speculations, calculations. And those impulses, which are rooted in a sense of self, more for me, when we act on them, they make things worse. We don't like unpleasant experience. It's unpleasant. And we'll do anything we can to not have to feel it, to feel sadness, including smashing up the store. You know, that's what people do. How do I make things okay? Sometimes it's not okay. Sometimes there's going to be sickness, illness, old age, sorrow, pain, distress, lamentation, despair, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, losing what you cherish. This is the elements of dukkha. Learning to simply be with unpleasant experience, very tough. I met a woman who had been a photographer, and she was doing some work in Laos. And she was riding on one of those jitneys through the countryside, and a truck came, and she was hanging on to the outside the way people do, so a public bus thing. And a truck smashed, killed everybody except her, and it sent her flying, and she landed and couldn't move. She was there for, I can't remember the exact time, but it feels like hours. And she said she went to a practice. And she just stayed with what was present. And then when people found her, they put her in the back of a pickup truck and drove for an hour and a half over dirt roads and miles to the hospital. She did the same thing. She had some incredible internal injuries. When I met her, she still had gravel embedded in her arm. The doctor said if she had struggled, she would have died for sure. Learning to be with unpleasant experience. We don't want to do it, but sometimes it's going to be necessary because you won't be able to get rid of unpleasant experience. They don't make the analgesic tablet that will actually kill the pain. Aside from unconsciousness. And then, thinking of the fifth precept, do we provide drugs that work towards heedlessness if someone is in that serious terminal pain? The answer is about compassion, not moralism, not fundamentalism. But learning to be with pain, being with pain, with unpleasant experience, so when we encounter it in the form of sorrow or distress, so what's present right now? Like the Buddha, this place seems empty without my friends. That's why that thing that Ajahn Amaro said about the sitting, and learning to be with the discomfort when it shows up. Learning that place where the action of aversion is not aversion, but it's compassion. When it's out of aversion, it's one thing to change position. If it's out of compassion, it's another. If your public protest is out of anger and aversion, it's one thing. If it's out of compassion, it's something else. Engage Buddhism, what is the engagement? Equanimity is fully engaged. It's not whatever. It's not indifferent. So these two fetters are the focus of the next two levels of arising, of enlightenment. Some attenuation of the desire for pleasant experience makes you a once returner. Once returner, the idea is that you return to human form once more. And when, so that's the attenuation of Rupa Raga, and the attention of the apada, it's the attenuation of those two. The complete evaporation of those. It's interesting, it's the evaporation of the hindrances. It's not of tanha, we just don't bite from the bait. We don't take the bait. That flame, whatever that flame is, the outcome that we want to have happen, we don't snap at that bait. If we snap at that bait, now there's a hook, and we suffer. But the final evaporation of the final evaporation of sensual desire and ill will is the once returner. Now, I guess the idea
non-returner.
I guess the idea is that if you no longer have any kind of taste for pleasant worldly experience, then there would be no reason to be reborn, and we would be reborn in the higher heavens, or wherever those are. And just because they're imaginary doesn't mean they don't exist as imaginary. They may actually exist. I don't know. How would I know? Now, Bhikkhu Bodhi explained to me that the six Dharma realms actually do exist. Really? Yeah. The hungry ghosts, they're right here. Our sensorium is just not attuned to those levels. And I think, well, how do we know that? If we can't detect it, who would know it? Well, I guess it's a secret, private knowledge that... But I think that the non-returner just means non-return to the sadness, in my view, of craving, the frustration. Buddha uses the image of the dog with a bone that's been smeared with blood. And the dog gnaws and gnaws and gnaws. Well, how much nutrition is he going to get out of it? Not much, but there's a lot of anticipation. So the idea of the end of rebirth in that sense is metaphorical. I interpret a lot of what the Buddha's teachings as metaphorical in this way. So these are the second and third stages of enlightenment. Before I move on to arhatship, let me just check in and see whether you guys are cool with sense desire and ill will. No questions? Got that under control? Good. Life is good in the Central Valley. The last five fetters are all all related to or the cessation of which are all related to the attainment of arhatship and mastery. And there are five of them. And once again, the image for me is that they evaporate rather than are muscled down. This isn't an arm wrestling thing. They just evaporate. They, in the first of the suttas in the Sutta Nipata, thank you. And the Sutta Nipata is the Uraga Sutta is about 17 or 18 verses, and the refrain, each verse is the same, and it has the images like a snake shedding its worn out skin. And it seems to me that that's the awakened path, shedding the old skin, just abandoning, just leaving it.
Yeah.
I
just wanted to comment on that, yeah, because we were talking about the word abandoning. Mm-hmm. And in that way, you know, abandoning is not something that we do, or at least, you know, in this particular framework, it's that we find that it no longer is useful, it no longer suits us, and we just abandon it as it's baggage, right? As opposed to saying, oh, it's something I have to actually do as an action. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think that's why sometimes people get a little confused around abandoning as an activity as opposed to something that naturally just, it falls away, it sloughs off in the process.
We were coming close to this, the discussion at lunch about free will. We got close to the issue of free will. And everything, you know, conditioned. Where is the free will? And the way I think of it is that it's not so much because, you know, the conditions of your life will determine, will produce behavior vectors that, you know, independent of our will often. Where is the freedom? Where is the free will? And I think of it more as free won't. Really, because, you know, wanting things to go away is a kind of wanting, it's a conditioned thing. Free won't is the impulse arises, we recognize it and say, not today. I know where that one goes. Been there before. If I say this, he's going to say that, and the next thing makes Christmas dinner easier. Free won't. And it's not, and it's free won't in the service of the attenuation of dukkha, so it's not out of keeping with our, if you want to talk about our essence, as beings that want less pain. At a certain point, we want less unpleasant. And this is a way to remove the unpleasant that we contribute. That tanha stuff, that kamachanda stuff, that's what we contribute to the experience. It's a commentary. It's an addition to what's unpleasant already. I'm angry. Oh, and I shouldn't be angry because I've been practicing for so long. What does this mean? Oh, well, maybe the teachings are all wrong. Maybe, I mean, you know, you that's added. Just sad or angry. Anger has arisen. You know, if you look at the third foundation, the Buddha doesn't say, you know, he recognizes a mind filled with anger as a mind filled with anger. He doesn't say, that's what he says, he doesn't say, get rid of that anger. Make it go away. That's just aversion. I love Eugene Cash's. Aversion to aversion is still aversion. So you're not abandoning through aversion. You're abandoning through, you just step away from that desire. Step back. It's free want. It's won't get sucked in. Won't take that bait. Greetings. I'm authorized to offer you $2.5 million that was left in an account in Nigeria. If you'll only send me all your passwords and social security number, we'll transfer it to you directly. It's just the bait. And we see the bait then. We don't see the bait most of the time. We're just falling for it. It's the moth and the flame. You just fall for it. Now the last five elements, these are our hardship elements, and so teachers generally will go through them real quick because, well, these are the last to go, so it's like death. Later, we hope. We're not to it right now. So there's this sense that, well, we can deal with maybe views. And now we're dealing with, how do they translate Ruparaga? Craving for fine material existence. The traditional interpretation is that is craving for the lower jhanas. I sort of interpret it a little differently. I don't see the Buddha interpreting it differently. in the canon. So it could very well be that this interpretation of it being the lower jhanas is a later addition. Rupa is the physical, the body stuff. So I sort of see it as fine material, fine this worldly. And you might be able to see it as at the mind sensegate. Or it could be the jhana states. The idea is that these sublime, these exquisite attainments, sometimes you've been sitting on retreat for a while and oh my gosh, it can be just more pleasant. It's just hard to believe. And then people get attached to that. I want that again. First time I ever had that happen, I spent 2 years trying to regain it. I swear, and I've heard Joseph Goldstein tell a story about how he'd been meditating in India and he was, it was really cooking. And then he got a notice his father was ill and he had to come back to deal with him. When he finally got back to India, he spent, I don't remember whether he said two, but he spent a long time, I think it was 2 years, trying to recover the states that he'd been attaining before he realized, well, I'm supposed to be here now. What's going on here? And dealing with that. I heard that story. I did the same thing. Just, very pleasant experience is very captivating. We think about it. We dream about it. Craving for fine material and craving for immaterial existence. That's for existence. It's traditionally thought as the higher jhanas, which most of us probably don't have a lot of experience with, so that's really off there. But if we had experience of it, we'd want it. We'd contemplate it, figure out. If I hold my hands this way, will I get there? Maybe not this way. Keep my back straight. Whatever. How do I get that again? That's just the same calculation. How to make things pleasant. We talk about restlessness and conceit. I think I say conceit is like the blue dot on the GPS. This incredibly powerful map. It is, it's just amazing what we can do with our mind. And I can outsmart my dog, because his brain's only this big. And he's a dog. And he has no guile. So he's at a disadvantage. This map that this brain produces of our world of experience, the world, makes sense as a survival artifact only with that blue dot, only with the sense of self. Here I am, here's how I get there, here's how I navigate. And I think it happens automatically. It's a reflex. I've seen it show up with no, I'm not even following a thought. A sound comes up and all of a sudden there's a comparing, I'm not like that, or I forgot that. There's self comes in. Somebody sneezes, I forgot to bring Kleenex for myself. Self shows up. It's that blue, and conceit comes with the world that we create. There's a sutta, the Sabha Sutta, Sutta of the All, which says, I'll tell you what everything is. I'll tell you about the All, everything. Sights, sounds, tastes, smells, touches, and thoughts. Then he says, anybody who talks about anything beyond this is going beyond what they know. What they know for themselves. What they know for themselves is the Buddhist standard. That's not a bad thing, because for us who've been cultured in the West, knowing for yourself, probably a big piece of our standard, we may take our mom's word for stuff. And sometimes it's kind of funny. We were talking about cooking earlier, about the story about the woman who takes a whole ham and cuts off the end of it from the joint before putting it in the oven. And when she was asked about it, she says, I don't really know. It's like the way my mom always did it. So I think I'll ask my mom. She asked her mom, yeah, our oven was too small for the whole. She thought it was quite, you know. We'll take a word for it. By the way, I have a friend who brought home a Southern Country ham that was this big. And he desalted it in his dishwasher, so that's just... He didn't add the detergent, but you just run the... Work great. Conceit comes with the map of the world. The map of the world comes with the self. Self and other come together. They happen together. So the trick isn't to make them go away. You can't... Who would make them go away? Who would make conceit go away? Who could possibly? Me. I'll make conceit go away. The conceit and the world, they're interdependent, and they happen together. This is how I understand it. And the trick is to learn to see it clearly. The more clearly you can see it and understand it. It's like the more I opened the hood of the car and the more clearly I could discriminate what was going on in there, the better chance I had of rebuilding the car. You know, if I don't know what I'm looking at, I asked... I asked one of the people I was working with the other day what the difference was between craving and desire. And he thought and said, I don't know. I thought, well, you know, if you don't know, I mean, it's okay not to know, but it doesn't, there's not the ability to deal with it. So we want to become more sensitive. We want to be able to discriminate some of these states, but they also create self. So we recognize self and other, we use them as tools, but the clinging part, the believing part, is what gets us in trouble. We get to God is blue, God is red stuff. Social justice is. No, that's not what social justice is. This is what social justice is. People should take care of themselves. People should be taken care of. Well, little path, you know. So conceit is a reflex that comes with the formulation of the world, of the all. It's a formulation of, it comes with the territory. And I actually think that all of these things at the end come with the territory. Well, they sort of all come with the territory. Just need to look at them and then exercise free will. Conceit. And then restlessness. Restlessness is one of the hindrances as well. It comes along with worry as a hindrance, Udacha Gukicha, but this is just Udacha, which is restlessness. Here's how I understand restlessness. If it's useful to you, I have a metaphysical correlate. I think of this organism is here in this world, and there is so much data coming at it. It's like a stream. Oh my gosh, a stream enterer. It's a stream. It's coming at us unrelentingly, and we can't process it all. Well, we do process, and we can't attend to it all. But the mind is the mind is focusing. Like right now, you're listening to what I'm saying, and you're paying attention to these You think it's sound, but you know, you're hearing the sound, but you're thinking the thoughts. And you're not noticing the sensations on the soles of your feet. When I mention the sensations on the soles of your feet and you quickly check them out, yep, feet still there, you know, that data was in the neurology already, but we weren't paying attention to it. You ever been at a party and there's sort of this rumble of conversation, this murmur, and then somebody says your name and you go, right? Your brain's listening, brain's processing all that, but we're not attending to it. It's a survival thing again. It's just scanning. Are we okay? Is this okay? Is everything okay? I was teaching some mindfulness practice to some of the psychiatric staff at Folsom Prison. And we were in a conference room in a secure part of the building, sort of secure. But APOD is dangerous. It's a psychiatric unit, and that means people can go off on you. So, you know, so I gave a little introduction, and I said, okay, let's close our eyes. And there were two people in the group who were afraid to close their eyes, even in a secure, and they said, not closing my eyes around the inmates. Just not safe. The organism wants to know, are we okay? Is this okay? And so it's constantly scanning. You know, somebody cuts in on you on the road, you don't think, someone is cutting in on me. I think I will hit the brake. That's a good thing. It just happens. Right? And then up comes the finger. It just happens. So this restlessness, I understand it as just part of the organism going over stuff. When you're asleep, the dreams going over stuff. When you're meditating, going over stuff. Papancha, going over stuff. Scanning, are we okay? Is there anything I could get to make it better? You know, in the service of pleasant becoming, getting rid of the unpleasant. How do we make things more pleasant, get rid of the unpleasant, and how to figure out how this relates to me? What do I do here? That's the restlessness. So, you know, it reflects a lack of peace. At the point where survival is totally no longer an issue, the mind sits at peace. Maybe not for everybody. I had a bout in the ER recently where I spent some time in an anaphylactic reaction, and I had no control. And I had no choice. I couldn't. The nurse said, breathe more deeply. I couldn't. I've been paying attention to my breath for a while. I couldn't. I had no control. And so I just let go totally and just watch. That's all you could do. So it was peace. There was no restlessness. It was amazing. As I recognized it, what I did was I took the opportunity to explore the skandhas. I didn't have anything else to do. And they were handy. But the restlessness, I've seen the cessation of restlessness. But it's all part of that underlying, that climate. I was talking about Tantra, with wanting things. It's the body's own independent, impersonal stuff. So in the last is ignorance. And I think we'll give it more than 10 minutes, actually. We should probably do maybe a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and finish up with ignorance. Ignorance could be the subject for a week-long retreat. But I think we'll try to keep it reasonable. So I'll ring a bell on it. About a quarter to when we get back here. But a stretch break, all-purpose break.